having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. We're here today for oral argument. The appeal numbers are 24-1531 and 25-2569. We'll begin with oral argument on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Clarence.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The issue here is one of contempt, whether Hytera abided by the express command of Judge Norgal's royalty order. Judge Norgal said that order applied specifically to the 41 products adjudicated at trial, and that's that were the basis of the jury's damages award.
Before we go too far down the contempt road, I want to clarify what's moot and what is still in this case from Hytera's perspective, because there were two appeals. The first appeal really involved the anti-injunction suit and contempt findings on the anti-injunction. And my understanding is that Hytera takes the position that that is now moot. Is that correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but I want to be clear. The anti-suit injunction is moot.
Yes.
The sanctions are all moot. I think that's all agreed. The only thing that wasn't moot was the $5 million fine.
Correct. So that's separate. I'm focused just on the on the first appeal now. There were two issues in there about the anti-suit injunction and contempt for violating the anti-suit injunction. It's Hytera's position that both of those issues are moot, so we don't need to do anything on the first appeal. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then on the second appeal, we have the H-series, which we'll get to, and I know that is not moot, but there was also, as you were just mentioning, the $5 million fine that was imposed on your client for the period of time where the court found you were not in compliance on the anti-suit injunction contempt order. Are you still pursuing that appeal? In your joint statement to the court, you sort of indicated you were going to withdraw that argument.
We are not pursuing that, Your Honor.
Okay, so you are withdrawing that argument, and that is, we do not need to decide that issue, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Now,
and
you could go back
well,
to...
I want to do a little bit of stage setting as well to make sure I understand our larger context here as well. First of all, can you tell us the status, and I'll ask Mr. O'Quinn this as well, about the status of damages after our previous remand, the issue of a permanent injunction, and what royalty payments have actually been made versus put into escrow. I'm curious about what dollars have actually changed hands at this point.
Sure, Your Honor. So damages, the total DITSA damages were around 475 or 490 million, depending on, it changes because there's continuing post-judgment interest. Mm-hmm. So these are rough numbers. Hytera has paid 235 million since this court issued its decision.
In July of 24.
Hytera, well, we had a rehearing request. There was some continued, and the mandate came back down, I think, in November or December. And then Hytera began paying at the January or so of 2025, or first quarter of 2025. And they paid $235 million, $240 million.
On the jury verdict.
On the jury verdict, yes.
And sure. There's also royalties.
Hytera has paid all of the royalties on the adjudicated products.
The 41 products. I remember there was a lot of back and forth about Canadian companies and escrows and so on, but that's been paid?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what was that sum, roughly?
The total sum today, Your Honor, is $55 million on adjudicated products.
Okay.
And again, $235 million on the DITSA damages award.
Yeah. Okay. And was the issue of allocation, has that been resolved in the district court, or is that still pending?
It is still pending, Your Honor,
okay,
on the copyright damages.
Yeah.
They were reduced from $136 million down to $14
million. Mm-hmm.
So all the extraterritorial sales went out. The $14 million apportionment is still under submission with the district court.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Please. Go ahead.
Okay. I guess Also, to be clear, the H series royalty, Hytera has offered to pay that. We have proposed to pay it into a court escrow pending appeal, and there has been some challenge about that. That motion's pending before the district court. It has been for about a year or so, but Hytera stands ready to pay that the minute we've got somewhere to pay it to. Okay. All right, so the Judge Norgal's royalty order is narrow, but it was narrow on purpose. It applies to the 41 adjudicated products because it's 100% of the royalty of those products. And that is based on the Judge Norgal's determination that those products practiced all 21 trade secrets that were at issue at trial. So it is a bespoke royalty for those adjudicated products. That's what it's for. If there's a future product that comes along that has that doesn't misappropriate trade secrets, or it's not subject to the royalty, or it misappropriates different trade secrets, if the profile of the infringement changes, then the royalty changes based, of course, on apportionment principles. Motorola actually asked for multiple times. They said, make it the 41 products plus any product in the future that misappropriates a trade secret. Or make it the 41 products plus any product in the future that is built on the accused, derived from the accused software. They also asked for a pre-clearance for any new product. So when Judge Norgal denied those first two requests, they said, well, at least give us pre-clearance. So any new product needs to come in and go through a six-month proceeding to make sure it's clean. And Judge Norgal said, look, that would basically change all this into an injunction. This is not an injunction. It's a royalty on the 41 products.
What about your client's comments that Hytera, if there were new products at issue, Motorola could bring a contempt proceeding against your client?
That's only part of what we said, Your Honor. And this is
that's a significant part. How should that impact our analysis of the scope of the royalty order?
Sure. So it's 100% consistent with our Four Corners position, Your Honor. What we said multiple times in the royalty briefing is that Motorola could bring a contempt for willful violation of the of an existing order or a new case. Now, at the time we made those statements, there was no order, so we couldn't be making any kind of pronouncement about the scope of the order because those statements were made in the process leading up to Judge Norgal issuing the royalty order. But we were very clear, and it's our same position today. When you're in this position, right, the first question, should you even be in contempt? To answer that question, you're going to look at the scope of the royalty order. Some royalty orders are broader than others. This one is very narrow, and it's purposefully narrow because it is a royalty that is bespoke for 21 trade secrets on these specific products.
So we're all taking a close look at Judge Norgal's statements, and it's understood that we have to read them for their full shrift. There's a specific statement at SA 163 and SA 170, and I'll quote it for you. Quote, a perpetual royalty ellipsis on Hytera's sales of its products that incorporate Motorola's misappropriated trade secrets ellipsis starting July 1st, 2019. Are we to read that as kind of a catch-all, that if a product that incorporates a misappropriated trade secret gets through, that still allows for a royalty, or am I reading that too closely?
So, Your Honor, where this comes up, I think, is in the context of Motorola had asked for a term in the final royalty agreement that required Hytera to keep the trade secrets confidential. And Judge Norgal granted that. We didn't oppose it. Judge Norgal granted that. And it was in that context that Judge Norgal made statements about that you can only use the trade secrets for the adjudicated products. And so that was the context of that statement. The perpetual royalty statement is in the same context. It is a statement about the license that's being granted for the 41 products to use the 21 trade secrets. That's what it's about. What it doesn't mean, what it cannot mean, is that any new product that misappropriates a trade secret is covered by this royalty order or that a royalty is owed. It cannot mean that because Motorola asked for that twice and Judge Norgal denied that both times.
Is it correct, counsel, that the passage that Chief Judge Brennan just quoted was written by Judge Norgal about 3 months before the royalty order was issued?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. That is 100% correct.
Thank you.
So actually, the first time that Motorola asked for a provision that would apply to future products was actually in the injunction. And I'm going back there because it's the issue is fleshed out there a little more. Hytera argued that an injunction that applies not to specific products, but that to future products based on a standard of trade secret misappropriation, that that's too ambiguous to go in an injunction. It violates Rule 65. We cited American Can for that, which is very clear on that point, and Judge Norgal denied it based on that point. So that really all carries over to the royalty because it's the same point. You also can't include in a royalty any kind of provision that says pay a royalty on future products that satisfy, you know, a vague standard, an open-ended standard. American Can stands for that proposition. And then, of course, all the cases, D. Patrick and so forth, make very clear that if you have a provision like that, you certainly can't be in contempt because it's ambiguous and you have to go out. It's not a clear and express pronouncement of a command of the royalty.
If you're correct that the royalty order does not cover the H-series products, could Motorola go back in at this point and ask the court to modify the royalty order?
I think Motorola has a lot of options, and we have not exhaustively researched that procedural issue. Without a doubt, Motorola can bring a new proceeding. Certainly, Motorola could file a complaint, accuse the H series of trade secret misappropriation. And of course, we wouldn't be starting over. There's a lot that is used in the record. The discovery's all out there. Expert reports are out there. A lot of that can be reused. So it's not starting over. You know, I think as probably this court remembers from the first appeal, there's a lot of, it all came up through Judge Norgal because there was not an at-law remedy, but an equitable remedy through unjust enrichment. And so that goes to the court. And so it's certainly possible that Motorola could tailor the relief they ask or the type of proceeding they bring to one in equity and be in front of the court. So I think that is something that's open. I haven't mapped it out, but there are certainly, we're not starting from scratch, so to speak.
I'm kind of wondering how much is actually at stake here. I read the district judge's findings, Mr. Kloren, as saying, in essence, the H-series continued the misappropriation of trade secrets. I understand your point that that's not necessarily the same as violating the royalty order and that those are actually two quite distinct questions. And we'll, I'm sure, talk with both sides about that. But I'm wondering about, in essence, the district judge seems to have found seems to have applied, at least to my eyes, a kind of substantially derived from the trade secret standard, which would bode ill for the H series on the merits of a straight trade secret claim as distinct from a contempt of court claim. So I guess I'm wondering how much do you benefit from convincing us the wrong procedural tack was used, but you're still going to face litigation on whether the H-series products violate or misappropriate trade secrets?
Sure, Your Honor. We think it's a huge difference, and we don't at all think that the district court applied a substantial derivation analysis. The district court specifically applied what's called substantial similarity, and that's hugely different. It's a completely different analysis. So the district court said, here's the H series, and I'm comparing the H series to the adjudicated products from trial. And are they similar?
I agree there's some language in the order that talks about similarity, but the district court specifically found that the H series products are substantially derived from the trade secrets embodied in the products adjudicated.
Your Honor, the only place, so...
So, let's assume the court applied substantially derived, then maybe answer Judge Hamilton's question with that assumption.
So the court did not apply the substantial derivation standard. The court...
Let's assume that it did.
Okay.
And then answer Judge Hamilton's question. What's the benefit here? How far ahead are you, or what are you really getting out of this if the court did apply the substantially derived standard? But you're correct about your contempt arguments, and this doesn't fall within the scope of the royalty order. Aren't you just going to end up at the same place?
Well, number one, Your Honor, we don't have a contempt, and that's a big deal. Contempt is a big deal. And this court's cases, there's a number of them that really talk about that. D. Patrick, H.K. Porter, you know, H.K. Porter says, because of the risk of contempt proceedings, civil or criminal, paramount interests of liberty and due process make it indispensable to speak clearly. So the having another contempt on Hytera's record would be a big deal. You know, Hytera already has a contempt of the anti-suit injunction order, and in opinions where we're talking about damages or other issues, this sort of character just comes up. Right, it comes up, and Hytera really wants to avoid that. They did not violate this order, and it's important that we not have sort of history saying that we did. So that is a big deal because there may be litigation in the future. It's also really important because that's the law, that's the rule of the Seventh Circuit, and it's not always going to be Hytera standing here. Right, there's a case right now where Apple is facing this exact same issue. In a litigation against Epic. And so, you know, sometimes there's going to be a great American company standing here, and the rule needs to be applied. So, but more on the substance here, Your Honor, sort of outside of that policy. At a new trial, it's this 100% royalty. A 100% royalty was applied. So there's some undisputed facts that show that shouldn't be the case. On page 11 of our brief, we have this chart. And this chart shows all of the modules that were accused at trial and that they were all deleted and replaced either with code from a clean room or from a third party. Every software module that was accused at trial. So if there's what would happen at a new trial is maybe some of these we did good enough on, maybe some of these we didn't. I think we did good enough on all of them. But there would be an apportionment analysis. It's not a foregone conclusion that 100% royalty applies. It's not a foregone conclusion that 21 trade secrets are still misappropriated. The district court admits that lots of changes were made, but then says, well, but you didn't start from scratch. And that seems to be the biggest concern of the district court, right? The district court doesn't dispute that we didn't start with the code in the adjudicated products. We started with what's called a Gen 2 code base, a different code base. Motorola's expert admitted, and the district court agreed, that is light years removed from the code in the accused products. So right there, it's a different product in the story. But we went farther. We deleted 40% of that code. So it's 1.3 million lines. We deleted 500,000 lines out of 1.3 million.
Am I remembering correctly that a lot of that had to do with revision history and comments in the code?
No, Your Honor. That was a suggestion that was made, and that's why it's really important to look past sort of characterizations and broad statements and labels. Because Dr. Wicker admitted that 400 out of the 500,000 lines, 420,000 of those lines are functional code that makes a difference in how the product operates. Mm-hmm. Now, because 80,000, it doesn't mean anything that 80,000 lines are not functional code. Mm-hmm. When you change out all the functional code in a file, the name of the file is going to change too. So there's always going to be some cosmetic changes along with changes of substance. So the court does not dispute that Tons of changes were made. The court, what the court's problem, and this is, I do want to get back and preserve, I want to be able to state what the court looked at is similarity in functions. So the court found contempt because it said the H series has similar functions to the adjudicated products. But every single one of the trade secrets, which are radio features and functions, every single one is in every single digital radio. 80 manufacturers make digital radios. Every one of them have things called squelch, carrier detection, timing and framing, all the things that are on my chart, all the things that are Motorola's listed trade secrets. Every radio has those. And the court at A15, what the court doesn't dispute this. The court says Motorola's trade secrets are compilations of public information. And what Motorola's trade secrets are, they're not the basic functions. Instead, they are Motorola's implementations of those public functions. Everybody has one. It's sort of like everybody knows how to make chocolate chip cookies, but my grandmother has a bespoke, particular chocolate chip cookie recipe. So it's just Motorola's implementation of something the industry already knows how to do. And Wicker acknowledged at SA 485 and SA 745 through 746 and SA 753 that Hytera and everybody else in the industry can all have these functions. So looking at functional similarity between the new redesigned accused product and the products that were previously adjudicated is the wrong thing. Just looking at the wrong thing. So I want to go back to this substantial derivation point. The court does mention the words in a 49-page opinion one time, substantial derivation. Mentions similarity hundreds of times. Mentions substantial derivation once, and it's at page 42. At the very conclusion of the liability section, the court finds that because Hytera did not start from scratch, the H-series products are substantially derived from the trade secrets embodied in the products adjudicated at trial, providing further support for substantial likeness. The court's analysis is one of substantial likeness. It is 49 pages of substantial likeness between the product, H-series, the new product, and the previously adjudicated ones. American Can says, as clear as day, that you can't do that, that that is the wrong test. You have to do the substantial derivation test. The court mentions substantial derivation one time and one time only. It's on page 42. And he says that it's sort of a subset leading up to supporting the finding of substantial likeness number one. But she gets to substantial derivation simply because Hytera didn't start from scratch. That's why. Not from saying, here's the trade secret, and here is the new H-series implementation of Squelch. And the trade secret
what
is just...
What about the finding, though, that Hytera built the Gen 2 code base based on Motorola's trade secrets? She specifically found that.
She also... That's internally inconsistent, Your Honor. Again, that's a more general statement. The district court agrees that the Gen 2 is light years removed from the adjudicated products, number one. The district court also agrees that a team went through with two outside monitors hired to go through and find anything in this Gen 2 code base.
So you're saying that finding is clearly erroneous based on her other findings?
Correct, Your Honor. It is. It is because it is undisputed that the Gen 2 code base is light years removed from the adjudicated products, number one. And it is true that we had people go through and find anything in the Gen 2 code base that was in any way related to the anything that was accused at trial. Any function, radio function that was accused at trial was deleted and replaced with a third party open source solution or something from a clean room. And that's not disputed either. Again, what the district court says, this is, well, you have the same functions and you kind of keep the same architecture, right? If you're just sort of, if you're pulling out this bad piece and putting a good piece in, maybe you address that, but you've still got an architecture problem. And so I do want, again, that is inconsistent with the undisputed facts. And so Professor Wicker says at essay 44 and 45 that Motorola's architecture trade secret is a five-layered architecture, and the adjudicated products have a five-layered architecture. At the contempt hearing, and this is, I apologize, it's not in the appendix, so it's record 1759, the contempt hearing transcript, page 631, lines 15 to 22, Dr. Wicker says the H-series has a three-layered architecture. And the DMR standard, the public standard, also has a three-layer architecture. So Hytera went back to that, to something public. And the district court says architecture wasn't touched, but that's just contrary to Dr. Wicker's own admission. So again, we implore the court to look beyond sort of broader characterizations.
Mr. Corn, could I ask you quickly on, there was a lot of debate about the, I think the so-called scope map document from early in the redesign process. And could you point us to the strongest evidence that you think the district judge was required to believe from your side about the significance of that document?
Sure, Your Honor. First of all, legal errors resolve the issue, so this court doesn't need to get to that.
I understand that.
Sure. Thank you. The district court did commit that factual error. The court looked at the scope map, and she points that out on A21. Ignored evidence of what Hytera actually did. That's in our opening brief at 61 to 64.
My question is, what was the district judge required to believe from your side about that?
So all of those trade secrets were, in fact, touched. Number one, the scope map doesn't say they weren't touched. What the scope map says,
I'm sorry to be pressing. I understand the arguments. I understand your position and the factual arguments you made. You're making a clearly erroneous challenge, and I'm asking what evidence the district judge was required to believe from your side that would require her to accept your story.
Understood, Your Honor. The first one was protocol stack. She says on page 21 of her opinion it wasn't touched. On page 22, she concedes that there were 40,000 changes, that it was modified, and there were like 40,000 changes made. Dr. Wicker confirmed 40,000 changes were made. Number two, on architecture, I just said it. There, Dr. Wicker admitted that they went from a five-layer architecture to a three-layer architecture. So that was one of the eight untouched. For the next five untouched, they are the so-called umbrella trade secrets. So it's the whole code, or all the code in the mobile radio, or all the code in the portable radio, which goes in the cars, right? So it's, and those, it is undisputed that those buckets of code, big buckets of code, contain all the individual modules that we replaced. And I think she concedes on, it's either A22 or A42, I apologize, but it's in our brief, Judge Packle concedes that all these changes were made. So when we switched out Vox, when we changed the protocol stack, when we switched out the timing and framing or the application framework, then that changes the whole code. And so by addressing all of the modules that were accused at trial, we also addressed the whole code trade secret. We also
saved some
all the
time.
Umbrellas. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Claren. We'll now move to argument on behalf of the appellee, Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you, Chief Judge Brennan. May it please the court, John O'Quinn on behalf of Motorola. I would like to start with a couple of the points that my colleague on the other side was addressing, because I just want to clarify the record on it.
Before you jump in on the H-series, I want to ask you the same question.
Sure.
Do you agree that the only issue before the court now is the issue surrounding the H-series and the court's contempt finding with respect to the H-series?
I agree that between mootness, between compliance with the district court's orders, and their withdrawal of the $5 million fine issue, that the only issue that remains is the H series issue.
Okay.
Yes, Judge.
Thank you.
And do you agree about the money that changed hands?
So generally, yes, Judge Brennan. Judge Hamilton. You had asked a question that I don't think got addressed, which is, what's the status of the injunction on remand? And that is still pending. Okay. This court had remanded for reconsideration. Mm-hmm. That is still pending. The other thing that I would point out, and I agree in terms of the order of magnitude, I don't know about the at very specific numbers of how much has been paid, but it's about a little less than half of the entire original damages award. The royalty payment has been paid. I would point out that the royalty payment has now reduced to a trickle. The last royalty payment was $11,000. And the reason that the royalty payment has reduced to a trickle is because, of course, they have replaced those products with the H-Series products, which is why we're here on whether or not they can circumvent the royalty order. I want to clarify a couple of factual things, and then Chief Judge Brennan, I want to come back to the point that you made about reading the order in context, because there was an unbroken chain of orders that the district court issued leading up to the actual royalty order itself. And I think those provide very, very important context. But first, on this Lightyear's point, the statement in their brief is frankly misleading. That involves solely a comparison between the Gen 2 code base and one set of adjudicated products. There were different sets of adjudicated products. There were their original products, in which they copied wholesale and copied from Motorola's source code and materials. They had a first redesign, and that first redesign was also adjudicated. That's the PDC 760 product. And the district court found at A16 that they made the calculated decision not to start from scratch, and that the Gen 2 code base shared a common ancestor with the adjudicated PDC 760 code. No one said that that was light years removed. Quite the opposite. At MSA 223 to 225, Dr. Wicker testified about the hundreds of thousands of similarities between PDC 760 and Gen 2. The only thing that he said was light years, and I want to put what he meant by that into context as well, is the only thing he admitted in response to a question was light years different was some of the things that ran on the old C55 hardware. That was their original. But that's not all that was adjudicated at trial. And by light years, what he was referring to was so-called minimum differences. If there was any change whatsoever, like a change in the name of a function, then that counted both as an addition and a deletion. And when you add all that up, there were a number of changes. But it turns out, and Judge Packold heard extensive evidence about this, that most of those changes were, in fact, very superficial changes. So first of all, as my colleague on the other side noted, two-thirds of the code here is unchanged, just to begin with. And for the code that was changed, changes were things like this that you can see at 395 to 396 of the hearing transcript, literally changing the word frame to burst everywhere that appeared. Or you can see at MSA 209 to 210 that they renamed a function and went from HRCP reply to HRCP result. And similarly, at MSA 218, they just inserted RT in front of a number of the variables. So it went from PT110 to RTP110.
Is it your position, Mr. O'Quinn, that the district court applied the substantially derived from test, or that the district court applied the substantially like test, and that is appropriate?
Judge St. Eve, I think the district court did both. I think the district court, at Hytera's invitation, and this comes back to one of the things that you asked about earlier, at R1130, page 15, they specifically argued, and we can walk through exactly what they said, that contempt was the right way to address these types of issues. And they specifically pointed the district court at that point to the TiVo test in the Federal Circuit, and noted that it could be modified in the trade secret context, and in fact had been modified in the trade secret context. I really emphasize, read exactly what they said at R1130 at page 15. And so what the district court did here was she first looked to see whether or not it was substantially like. I don't think there's a material difference between that and the not colorably different test that the Federal Circuit has articulated in that context. And then after doing all that, she found that the products were also still substantially derived. And that was the
quote. What is your argument that the correct test is? Because those do seem like two different tests.
Well, Judge Saini, I think under this court's precedence in computer displays and syntax and shearing, that all that is required in the contempt context is to look in context, are the products substantially like? And the question that the court has to grapple with is what is the degree of sameness versus the degree of change? That's this court's opinion in computer displays at 1156. Now, Hytera relies heavily but mistakenly on the American Can 2 decision. And part of why it's a mistake right out of the box is American Can 2 was not about contempt at all. The court was not addressing contempt. The court was addressing likelihood of success on the merits in the context of a new preliminary injunction. And you can see that at page 318 of this court's opinion and footnote 5 of this court's opinion. Now, I do think that when you are answering the question of whether or not there is substantial likeness, but both this court's precedents and the analogous Federal Circuit precedents in the TiVo context say it does depend on the circumstances. And so American Can 2, while I think is not really on point, is not wrong in suggesting that the narrowness of a trade secret would matter versus the broadness of a trade secret. And of course, you have a factual finding here at A36 that the trade secrets at issue were Motorola's playbook, that they were, quote, extremely broad. And American Can 2 acknowledges that, quote, in most cases, the close similarities between the products would no doubt support findings that the trade secrets had been misappropriated, end quote. To be sure, there may be specific circumstances. This is a proceeding in equity. The court is to do equity. And there may be circumstances where, given the specifics of the trade secrets, that substantial likeness requires almost identicality. Both TiVo and this court in computer displays have said that it is a factual inquiry. And again, the TiVo case recognized that the question is whether or not the difference is significant. Because at the end of the day, what you're really trying to get here is whether or not it's different enough to raise a fair ground of doubt as to the wrongfulness of the defendant's conduct. That's the ultimate test, as the Supreme Court has articulated it in Taggart versus Lawrenson. And I think the substantial likeness test certainly answers the mail on that. Now, I do think that substantial derivation does sort of serve as an important, as a potential check, and sort of is analogous to the second step of the TiVo test. Because in TiVo, the Federal Circuit has said there are two parts. Is it substantially like? That gets you, that's for deciding whether or not contempt is the proper mechanism. Does it still infringe? Of course, you're talking about patent infringement in that context. And here, I think it's not just the statement on A42 where she concludes that the products are substantially derived. She lays out at A35 that they were, quote, built. The new H series was, quote, built on the foundation of Motorola's trade secrets, that their teams, quote, drew on pre-existing knowledge of the contaminated code base, end quote, in writing the code and specifications. That's at A41. And A42, and this gets to responding to some of the factual points that my colleague on the other side raised, that they, quote, relied on Motorola's trade secrets to know what problems needed to be solved in the first place, end quote. That is trade secret misappropriation. She also said it at A42 that they did not develop these fundamental building blocks of a DMR radio independently. Again, that's at A42. Instead, as she said at A39, they retained the, quote, significant advantage that Hytera derived from its misappropriation.
Mr. O'Quinn, what about the argument that's going to be advanced by Hytera that this technology has become so ubiquitous that it can't help but seep into some of the work that Hytera was doing on the redesign?
Yeah, so a couple of points in response to that, Chief Judge Brennan. So first, when you look, I think the district court here really focused on three things. Number one, their thoroughly tainted code base that they started from. So it doesn't matter if there are, you know, new developments in the technology. If they are using your trade secrets, then that is still misappropriation, even if it's out, if there are other aspects that are out in the public. Number two was she looked at the process that they used as being completely tainted. And so what they did, and Dr. Wicker testifies about this, is the functional equivalent of basically putting together the puzzle when you have the puzzle box in front of you. So yes, they were ostensibly coming up with their own new pieces, but they were doing it by looking at the puzzle box. That's still misappropriation. And then number three, she found that there is still substantial use of the trade secrets for the reasons that we talked about. And one of the ways that you can rest assured that this is still misappropriation is the timing.
The question really is not misappropriation here, right? The question is violation of the royalty order. And you've made, and Judge Packold made findings that, to my mind, show misappropriation. Maybe there's some errors in there, I'm not sure. That requires a level of engagement with the record that I haven't had a chance to do yet. But my biggest problem is that you are arguing for, and the district judge seems to have applied a test, a standard that Judge Norgal expressly rejected in drafting the royalty order.
No, I appreciate the question, Judge Hamilton. So let's turn to, please, this principal issue, because first of all, I think as Judge Packold observed in her own opinion, Judge Norgal simply was not prejudging the issue of whether or not the H series, would be in violation of the order. She specifically observed at A36 to A37 that he had not been presented with evidence about the H series. She says at R1503, this was the order in which she opened contempt proceedings, at pages 14 and 17, she makes the point that he simply did not prejudge hypothetical future contempt proceedings. But we knew those contempt proceedings were coming. And if we look, and this gets back to the question that you had asked the other side, Judge Brennan, if we look at the unbroken chain of orders that Judge Norgal entered, and we look particularly, Judge Hamilton, at their responses, and this is where I think that R1130 at page 15 is kind of the ball game here. This is the proceeding that they specifically asked for, that they specifically invited. Their move here was to oppose an injunction, say, you should do a reasonable royalty. They then opposed a pre-notice, and said, no, that would evade the contempt power, and that you can then resolve these things in the context of contempt. And so,
Mr. O'Quinn, if we look just at the text of the royalty order, though, it applies to covered products, which are defined as Hytera's products that Motorola specifically identified in its submission, and there were 41 products there. I think you would agree that the H series does not fall within that specific language.
I agree, Judge St. Eve, that the H series products are not listed there.
But if we look just at the text of the royalty order, does the H series fall within it, or do we need to look at this context and history to find that the H series products would fall within the royalty order?
Judge St. Eve, I think, first of all, you certainly can look at the context and history, and Judge Norgal.
That's a different question.
I understand.
I'm asking, do we need to?
No,
You had before the court was the royalty order, what's your strongest argument based on the language in the royalty order that the H series products fall within here? Because I don't see it in the text of the order.
My strongest argument is that is exactly the same issue that this court had before it in Motorola versus Computer Displays. And the question was, yes, there was a new series of displays that were made. And the court said, just because it has another number, just because you've made some changes, does not mean that it is not the same for purposes of the royalty order. And even Judge Norgal acknowledged that in his penultimate order here. He said, look, if you renumber a product and it's identical, well, that's going to still be covered. And then the question
is, that's not what we have here.
Well, it is and it isn't. And the reason that I say it that way is,
It's not a renumbered product, and it's not an identical product. I'm not saying you don't have misappropriation. I agree with what Judge Hamilton said.
Sure.
But the scope of covered products here, that's different than any misappropriation of the same trade secrets.
And Judge St. Eve, I think that is exactly what this court had before it, both in computer displays and in Syntax. And in computer, the facts of computer displays are eerily similar because you had sort of a background where all monitors in the world were about 50% the same. And even after the redesign, 60 to 70% of the circuits remained exactly alike. But the changes were equivalent in terms of like means and function and result. And this court specifically said at page 1156 that the real question is not whether there's been some change, but quote, the degree of change. And so the question is not whether there's pure identicality, but again, quoting from this court, the degree of identity and the degree of sameness. And this isn't something that's sui generis. This is exactly what the Federal Circuit has done, has endorsed in patent cases every single day, recognizing that if you have an order and it lists certain products, the question is if they come out with a new product, is that new product colorably different? Because if it's not more than colorably different, then for purposes of the order, whether it's an injunction order or any other remedial order, then it is the same product. And so I don't think you have to go outside of the four corners.
What about Judge Norgal's rejection of your argument, though, that the H-series should be included in the scope of the covered products?
I think that as Judge Packold observed, all Judge Norgal was doing was not prejudging something on which he had been presented no evidence. And he was doing exactly what Hytera invited him to do. Again, if you look at R1130 at page 15, they specifically said, you know, Motorola's proposal for 180 days notice before selling any radio product similarly circumvents the court's exercise of its contempt power. In the context of patent infringement, the determination of whether a redesigned patent violates an injunction requires a two-step test. They then articulate the TiVo test. And then they say this framework has been applied in the trade secrets context as well. And so what they say is that prejudging this and putting it in your order now is getting ahead of and circumventing your contempt power. And you may recall that Judge Norgal specifically said, this is at SA 161, this is one of the passages that you referenced a moment ago, Chief Judge Brennan, that you know, lack of notice will not, quote, leave Motorola without recourse. Hytera acknowledges the ability to initiate contempt proceedings, end quote. And this would basically be the ultimate bait and switch, having by Hytera, having thwarted an injunction by saying it should be a reasonable royalty, having thwarted any kind of notice or preclearance by saying, well, that gets ahead of contempt. Now contempt is here, and they want to feign surprise and say, well, that's not right either.
Well, I'm not sure that bait and switch is just in one direction here, right? Because we've got, you all proposed to Judge Norgal that the royalty order apply to, if I'm reading this correctly, all products developed in whole or in part with any of Motorola's trade secret information or copyrighted works, right? And he rejected that. But this sure feels like that's the standard being applied.
Well, Judge Hamilton, I don't think it is. And okay. I'll give you a very concrete example. If they developed a product that was not a radio, that was not a repeater, but used Motorola's trade secrets, I struggle to see how that would fit in the context of the order, because the order goes to, you know, radios and repeaters. So the idea that, you know, any and all uses of Motorola's trade secrets could be addressed in the context of contempt, I don't think follows. At the end of the day,
that seems a little far afield, since we're all talking here about competition with DMRs, right?
Well, that I think it was sort of my point, Judge Hamilton, and I think that's really the issue also in Apple versus Epic, where Epic versus Apple, where there had been an order about basically banning something, and then they came back and instead implemented some sort of a commission or royalty, and the court said, and that's the issue that the Supreme Court is now taking up, whether there was sufficient notice of that. And I think that's really kind of the key issue here. I mean, I hear you, Judge Hamilton. that you could, I can come up with hypotheticals where there would be unfair surprise. That's what this is ultimately all about. As this court in Shearing said, that it's ultimately about preventing unfair surprise. As this court said, quote, this is the standard implicit in the cases that discuss the specificity required of an injunction. And when Hytera itself has said, number one, the way to resolve this is contempt. Number two, the way to do it is through something that is analogous to the Federal Circuit's TiVo test. And that is what the district court has, in fact, done here. I mean, they complain half-heartedly that the district court didn't apply TiVo, but they don't tell you what difference that would possibly make. They don't tell you what's the difference between colorably different versus substantially like. And they certainly don't tell you what the difference is between infringement versus substantially derived. Again, it's a different context. The idea that they can complain that the court has looked to see are these substantially like does take chutzpah. And when you look at what the district court here found, I think it goes to how you know that these things are so much alike that it is appropriate for the royalty order to apply. I gave you the example of the name changes. Another thing that they did, they talk about how, oh, well, we changed the number of layers. What they did in many cases, as Dr. Wicker explained, is they've used technique to make things look different, but what's actually done is the same. They've flattened. They've taken it where one file would call another file, and they've just combined the two files together. You can see in the hearing transcript at 431, 448, 449, and perhaps even more egregiously, is they used the existing code and their knowledge of the trade secrets, and they worked backwards. And I point you to MSA 214 to 216, where Dr. Wicker explains that they start with the trade secret, and then they try to justify the change that they've made using open source act after the fact. He makes a similar point in the hearing transcript at 387 to 388. He says, the quote, the connection to the publicly known material is not what's driving the design. It's the trade secret. And so I think in this context, I mean, this is exactly what this court's decision in Computer Displays is ultimately about. Because to say that the order only prohibited in that case, quote, the sale of a display monitor series identical to the adjudicated one in all respects, or with only minor changes, would make the injunction meaningless, end quote. And so the principle to be applied here is, I think, a straightforward anti-circumvention principle that is no surprise to Hytera because it is exactly the tool, exactly the method that it specifically advocated for at R111, at R1130, page 15. So I'm obviously happy to answer questions that the court have because I want to be most attentive to the concerns that you have at this point. But I think that what Judge Packel did here was to identify properly that they started with a code base that was incurably contaminated. MSA 175, this is what our expert Dr. Rangan said, that the code base was incurably contaminated. That was their starting point. And just to be clear, Judge Hamilton, that is a code base that was part and parcel of the one that was used in PDC 760. Mm-hmm. It's basically combined PDC 760 product code and some of the Gen 1 code and took out some of the cellular phone features. That's where you get the Gen 2 code base from which they started. So right there, you're starting from essentially the same code base that has already been adjudicated, which that's right in the heartland of, I think, what Judge Norgel was worried about. The other thing that Judge Norgel, I think, made abundantly clear here, both at SA 161 and in the royalty order at SA 188, is that they could do one of two things. They could pay the royalty, or they could not use the trade secrets in any way, shape, or form, period. Mm-hmm. And so in a world where this isn't covered by the royalty, then yeah, it should absolutely be enjoined. And I guess that's what would happen next, if that's where we
end up. Well, that's also where I wanted to ask you, Mr. Quinn. If we were to disagree with the district judge about whether there was a, you know, clear and convincing evidence of a violation of an unambiguous command, unequivocal command, do you still have available to you a new misappropriation case under DTSA, or do you have other avenues available to you?
Well, Judge Hamilton, I don't think it would necessarily require a new DTSA claim as opposed to being an injunction that could be sought under the existing case, because the existing case is about the misappropriation of these 21 trade secrets. So, you know, in a world in which, you know, the court finds that contempt was not the proper vehicle, you know, I would anticipate, you know, then yes, you know,
give us an injunction that's broader.
We would move for a preliminary injunction, you know, I think the concern here
is, would you have to ask the royalty order to be expanded, the definition of covered products, in order to do that?
I don't think so, Judge St. Eve. We could do that. That would be an alternative, is to ask for a modification of the royalty order. I think what we would do is seek an injunction and then seek damages. I mean, I don't want to prejudge anything. This is all hypotheticals. But I would say that this is kind of the exact game of whack-a-mole that the Supreme Court warned against in McComb 336 U.S. at 192, which is that, you know, the court basically saw itself in a case where they were asserting that there was immunity from civil contempt because the plan or scheme, I'm quoting, which they adopted, was not specifically enjoined. And, you know, so the reasoning goes, civil contempt's avoided today by showing the specific plan adopted by respondents was not enjoined. Thereafter, the defendants work out another plan that wasn't specifically enjoined. Immunity is once again obtained from contempt because the new plan was not specifically enjoined, and so forth and so forth. And the court basically says that denies the parties the benefit of a remedial order. And that was one of the reasons that Judge Norgal did, you know, identify in granting the royalty and not granting the injunction. Part of it was the public interest at the time during COVID. That's long gone. The other part was to avoid the need for, quote, expensive, time-consuming quantification and requantification. That's an MSA 89. But that is exactly what we're going to now have, as opposed to getting the benefit of the royalty order that has now trickled to basically nothing, as they have gone on and really done, as Dr. Wicker said at hearing transcript 312 and 316, the same type of redesign process, and I'm using air quotes, for these products that they did for their first redesign, and frankly, for the original products themselves. Dr. Wicker testified at length about how the process was the same, and it resulted, you know, in the same result. And I would also add that when my colleague on the other side said, well, functionality shouldn't be fair game here because lots of people can do things lots of different ways. Dr. Wicker was very clear at SA 486 that when he was talking about functionality, and this is what the district court was relying on, that he was talking about the way the code proceeds to implement a given feature, not just the outcome that it produced. Yes, you know, if somebody has a different outcome, has the same outcome but does it a different way, that's one thing. But he was clear. He was talking about basically them engaging in the kind of techniques in order to just make cosmetic changes and rely on it working backwards.
Could you address your colleague's point about five-layered versus three-layered architecture?
I'd be happy to, Judge Hamilton. So one of the things, and I'll give you a specific example, there were different layers, and it really just goes to how you write code, and so that, you know, you do them in rather than have what they had to start with was a so-called spaghetti system, where it's just all thrown in together. Instead, you can write code in kind of a layered way, where this is a system that works together, this is a system that works together, they do interface with each other, but you can write them so that they have, you know, different things that do their own, essentially their own thing, but then work together in harmony. And one of the things that they did was they claim, and he points to page 11 of their brief, they're like, oh, well, we took out this, we took out that, we took out the other. None of that's true. And what I mean by that is that, yes, they made some cosmetic changes in some of those things, But for some of them, like the application layer and the ergonomic layer, what they did was they just combined them. Like they took pre-existing code and they took other pre-existing code and they put it together and they just simply combined them. And you can see this discussed at MSA 211 to 213. You can also see it in the hearing transcript at 460 to 468. And part of how you know this is because the new product still includes a reference to Motorola's EMT, its ergonomic management task. So they took the two things, ostensibly they took them out, but outside the clean room process, this clean room process is a little bit of a fiction. It was used for only 3 of the 21 trade secrets. It was used for less than a third of the code that was rewritten. Outside of that, most of the code was rewritten by admittedly dirty teams in terms of what was rewritten. And this is an example of that, where a dirty team took these things, they took them out, they put them back together, and then they put it back in. And one of the points that I think is important here that Dr. Wicker made, and I think made an impression on the district court, is no other company on earth could do what Hytera did, because it knew what was in Motorola's code in the first place that needed to be, like, you know, slightly excised, written to do the exact same thing, and then put back in. I mean, again, they're using the puzzle box in order to get there. And that goes to why the district court is absolutely correct factually, but I think it also sheds light on why this is the appropriate procedure for addressing this, because the question of substantial likeness here is one that they explicitly invited, and it is a way for courts to be able to avoid evasion of their orders.
Thank you, Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you, Chief Judge Brennan.
Mr. Clern, we'll give you 5 minutes of rebuttal.
May it please the court. So the contempt proceedings in front of Judge Packold were extremely expedited. All this happened in about 4 months. Judge Packold specifically held we're in contempt, so the rules of evidence don't apply, denying objection after objection. There was no discovery of Motorola. We were not allowed to take any discovery of Motorola. And so this was not an actual trade secret misappropriation trial. It was a one-way inquisition. End of story. We provided millions of documents over the course of maybe 3 or 4 weeks, 5 million documents. We weren't even allowed to review them. We just had to turn them all over. We could take no discovery of Motorola. No objections, no rules of evidence.
Although you had extensive discovery, though, from Motorola, from the trial itself over the covered products.
Years ago, since then, there's 80 manufacturers of DMR radios. There's a huge amount. That is basic trade secret law. What is generally known in the public changes. So we were allowed to have discovery over that. Judge Norgal agreed. The whole reason he didn't put in trade secret definitions is because there weren't any from trial. You had to look at 3 months of back and forth about here's what's known in the public, here's all Motorola's patents, here's their specific implementation of source code, where is the line? That was back and forth and back and forth over hundreds and hundreds of pages of expert and fact testimony. So that's one of the reasons that Judge Norgal said, yeah, there's a dispute over what the trade secrets are specifically, so I'm limiting it to 41 products. We needed to figure out what exactly is the scope of the trade secrets. That wasn't done. At the contempt proceeding, Judge Packle didn't look at here's the trade secret and here's what's in the H series. She didn't look at that either. She looked at the similarity between the H series and the adjudicated products, which American Can says that you cannot do. And here's the big thing. It is really that there's not really any dispute that a lot of the trade secrets were addressed. So at 41 to 42 of the district court's opinion, acknowledged that all the changes to the software modules that I showed on page 11 of our brief, so that's like 15 different modules, those are the trade secrets. Box, HAL, application framework, CPA, Roselle, Rapid, these are all the trade secrets. Those software modules were deleted, and that's admitted. Redesigned box in a clean room, A20. Replaced Rosal and Rappus, which were two accused modules, the related trade secret is VRIS, Virus, replaced those with something called TPL, which was written in a clean room, A21 and 22. That's not disputed. Removed the whole, this DMR DSP library, which was alleged at trial to have, to be the culprit of five trade secrets, and separately designed new equivalents. And then removed portions of the protocol stack. So right there, we have about 10 trade secrets that there is that there's not any dispute that they were taken out. And here's the quote: Hytera implemented different ways of solving those problems it had previously encountered via either third-party code or new code from a clean room. If it's from a third party, it's not a Motorola trade secret. And so the big difference is apportionment, right? Maybe we didn't get every trade secret. And maybe we didn't get architecture good enough, but there certainly was a change. And it's not a trivial change, it's a material change. The whole, Professor Wicker testified that everybody's allowed to have architecture. Everybody's allowed to have it. What architecture is about organizing things into layers and software code. So if you change the number of layers, that's a different architecture. And maybe that's still a trade secret misappropriation, maybe it's not. Judge Packle never even addressed that. So yes, an underlying trial would be different, and we think it would be a new jury trial on the question of liability. Whether damages ultimately are addressed by a jury, we don't know. But it would be a new jury trial on the question of liability.
Mr. Korn.
Yes, sure.
On the what seems to me at least the principal issue here about the clarity of the royalty order, your position clearly allows at least some wiggle room, right? Obviously, we have the renumbered, the relabeled kinds of products. So how would you articulate the line between what's prohibited and what's permitted? Or what's not forbidden by the royalty order itself?
Sure, Your Honor. So we think it's the 41 products, and the identical point came up merely in response to a complaint from Motorola. So this came around two times in two series of briefing. And the first time Judge Norgel said 41 products, and Motorola came back and said, come on, reconsider. That could lead to gamesmanship. What if they just changed the product number? Judge Norgel said, if they change the product number, but the product's identical, then you pay royalties all the same. So it's gotta be the identical product. And Motorola doesn't argue it's an identical product under any definition. Judge Packle didn't find it's an identical product under any definition. So we could have a fun debate about what if they changed the color. Yeah, it's probably still covered, right? But that's not the facts here. The facts here is that 40% was changed. And so if you look at me right now, and you can make some cosmetic changes, make my nails, cut my hair. If you change 40% of me, that's not cosmetic. You're getting into the meat somewhere, man. There's just no way that's cosmetic. And so again, we just ask to look past those labels. And finally, the one reference to substantial derivation is not the substantial derivation test, because Judge Packle never says, here's what the trade secrets are, and here are these new modules that she agrees are new and why they still misappropriate a trade secret. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Claren, and your team. Thank you, Mr. O'Quinn, and your team. The case will be taken under advisement.